KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm a professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have our Professor David Schanzer, who's an associate professor of practice at Duke Stanford School of Public Policy. David is going to be on the show today discussing the issues surrounding the leaks or the criminal acts, depending on your perspective, of Edward Snowden. I met David last month at a conference at Duke Law where I heard a fabulous discussion of Snowden from a perspective that is not often heard, at least within the radio waves of Stanford or at CIS. David's position is one that takes a view of Snowden as not a leaker, not a whistleblower, but more often than not, as one who's violated the law. But it's more nuanced than that. For those of you that, and anyone that pays attention to the internet or indeed reads a newspaper, should be familiar with this story. Over the last year plus at this point, Edward Snowden, through leaks, and again, or through violations of not only law but of contract, has revealed massive efforts on the part of the National Security Associates, as well as other intelligence apparatus of the United States government, to mine data from the internet and to follow communications and so forth. This information, which was revealed by Snowden starting last summer through The Guardian and other media outlets, has, from many perspectives, blown the doors open with regard to issues ranging from internet security to communication to how the government works with the internet. Over the course of the last year, there's been much discussion involving the question of what Snowden has revealed, not only substantively in terms of the actions of the intelligence community, but also procedurally in terms of how it is that the NSA was able to engage in these activities. And so there's been quite a bit of discussion of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, or FISA courts, which have operated largely in secret, but which are a judicial check against what should be or what thought to be possible abuses of this system. There's been much discussion involving the Patriot Act and other laws which arguably authorized or didn't authorize this behavior. But throughout this discussion, there's been a very robust debate about issues involving what the internet is, what privacy looks like on the internet, and ultimately who Snowden is and how he should be regarded. So in David's writing, as well as the presentation I saw at Duke, he takes a view of this issue as not being either entirely criminal or also entirely noble. And the difficult issues involving the checks and balances between freedom of the press and freedom of media to discuss these issues and the national security's interest in the United States is going to be one of our discussions today and one of our focuses. As we go through this discussion, and again, for those of you that are not only familiar with Hearsay Culture, but also familiar with the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, you would be aware that people like Jennifer Granick, who've been affiliated with CIS for quite a while, and others have written heavily on this issue and have taken the position generally that Snowden's activity should be lauded and that he should be viewed more as a leaker, and expressed enormous concern about NSA activity with regard to the internet. Hearsay Culture, although it is run through CIS, is a show that I have designed where I am putting on the journalist hat, meaning that I do not bring on guests that I wholly agree with. I don't bring on guests based upon whether I agree with them or not. Rather, I bring on guests based upon the questions of what issues I think are most important for my listeners to hear about and to get a wide range of perspectives on these issues. So the questions that I ask, regardless of whether I personally agree or not, are utterly unrelated to my own views, and therefore I ask the questions that, again, I think will elicit the best information. And so I say that up front because, again, CIS and particularly people like Jennifer have been very active in pushing a position here, and my goal here is not to either defend that position or to attack it or to support it, but rather to interview David, whose work runs the range of perspectives on these kinds of issues and who has written extensively on them. So by way of very brief background, David, again, is an associate professor of practice at Duke Stanford School of Public Policy. He's a director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security, and he's an affiliated faculty with the Duke Islamic Studies Center. He teaches courses on counterterrorism strategy, counterterrorism law, and homeland security at Duke. Prior to his academic appointments, he was a Democratic staff member for the House of Representatives Committee on Homeland Security in the mid-2000s. He practiced in the executive branch. He had positions, excuse me, in the executive branch, including special counsel, Office of General Counsel, Department of Defense, and he's also a trial attorney at the U.S. Department of Justice. We are recording this show on July 2nd. And David is joining us via Skype from Duke University's Media Studios. David, thank you much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Well, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, David, let me start off with a question I ask most of my guests. Tell us a bit more about your background and how you became focused on terrorism and national security issues.
Well, I enjoyed a 13-year career in Washington as a lawyer and as an advisor in Congress. And in one of my stints, I was a staff director in the U.S. Senate. And on the morning of 9/11, we were evacuated from our offices rather fearfully. And then the next year and a half, with that particular senator until she lost her reelection bid, I was very deeply involved in all of the policy reactions to 9/11, whether it was the Patriot Act or other legislation, border security, then, of course, the authorization for the Iraq War. So I was very deeply enmeshed and, you know, interested intellectually, but also patriotically, I think, in trying to figure out the right answers. As I said, she lost re-election in 2002, and then I moved over to become the staff director for the Democrats, the minority side at that time, over in the House of Representatives, a committee that was created right around the time that the new Department of Homeland Security was opening its doors. And we provided oversight and worked on legislation relating to what was then a very new concept and topic of homeland security. And I did that for 2 years and then had the opportunity to move here to Duke to start the center, to teach, open the opportunity to do research on a variety of these issues. I focus a lot on countering violent extremism here at home, work looking at how to build relationships between Muslim communities and law enforcement agencies to get together for the purpose of making their community safer, but also preventing acts of ideological extremism. Do a lot of teaching, both at the undergraduate level, but also executive education programs. And then I do get to do this fun stuff like commenting on issues of public concern, writing about it, and appearing in the media. So that's how I got here, and that's what I'm doing.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security? Is that an organization that focuses regionally on these issues? Does it have a broader charge? Tell us a bit about its structure.
Well, its charge was initially in 2005 to create a place of locus here in the Research Triangle region of North Carolina, where we have really a lot of amazing resources in terms of private companies, technology, and academic, with three major research universities and other smaller schools like Elon, like UNC Central nearby. So we had a lot of resources, and we thought we had a lot to contribute to the national debate and effort in this regard. And there wasn't really a central locus of activity. So the Triangle Center was set up to actually bring these two entities to coordinate some of their activities and essentially try to highlight our ability to make contributions, obviously interested in developing research grants and projects. And probably over the course of almost a decade now, we've done, I'd say, upwards of three or four dozen major federally funded research projects on one aspect of homeland security or another. Through my affiliate organizations, which have been Duke, of course, but also right down the street, UNC Chapel Hill, and then a non-for-profit research organization, RTI International. Those have been my main partners to do this kind of work.
How much interaction, before we focus on Snowden, but I'm curious, the Research Triangle obviously being one of the major technology innovation centers in the world at this point, obviously there's an enormous intersection and overlap between the technology sector and national defense. I'm curious, how much interaction have you seen, at least in the Research Triangle, between private industry and government with regard to the issues that we're going to be talking about today involving internet security and access communications and so forth? Is that an issue of particular activity in the triangle? Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
We have some big technology companies like Cisco that are active here, and of course IBM. I'm not really privy to their activities. We have a very big software developer, SaaS. I can't say, the extent to which they're involved. Not that I wouldn't say if I knew, but I really don't know. Also, Fort Bragg has become one of the biggest, most important Army bases. It's home to the our special forces and JSOC. So there's a lot of contract organizations, support organizations, analytical entities that do work on a contract basis for the special operations community. That would probably involve signals intelligence issues as well, and whether they're working for the military or for other organizations in the intelligence community.
We're chatting with Professor David Schanzer at Duke University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. David, let me ask this. We're going to turn towards Snowden now, and I'm going to ask you a very simple and top-level question, which is to describe, in a couple of minutes, the role of the National Security Agency in our broader intelligence apparatus and government. And the reason I asked the question is I think probably a year and a half ago, very few people would have heard of the NSA, much less be able to define it, and obviously it's been all over the news since. So for those that aren't familiar, how would you describe the NSA in really a couple of minutes?
Okay. Well, the intelligence of, don't hold me to this, I think 16 or 17 different agencies or sub-agencies in the government. And all of their general charge is to essentially collect information and provide it to policymakers to help inform their decision-making. Some of the agencies are housed and located within the Department of Defense and have as their main purpose to provide information for the military for their to support their operations throughout the world. The NSA is one of those agencies that actually is located within the Department of Defense, but it actually has a much broader mandate. Its particular mandate is to collect what we call signals intelligence, so intelligence that is gathered through electronic means to capture communications of others, whether it be via telephone or satellite phone or the internet or all the new different kinds of electronic devices that are proliferating today. There are other parts of the intelligence community, for example, like the CIA, that focuses more on human intelligence and covert operations. That's not what the NSA is doing. It is really a signals intelligence collection agency. It's located in DOD, but it also serves the purposes of the general government to provide information to help inform policymakers.
So when we think about the NSA today, and the precursor to the question is what I just mentioned, my sense, David, I'm curious to get your perspective, having been around these issues for quite a while, is that as it stands today, there's a lot of information and really, I think, misunderstanding and misinformation that's out there about the NSA itself. And I'm curious to get your perspective on that. I mean, what has been, before we even talk about Snowden, what has been the impact on the public's understanding of the NSA, in your view, post-Snowden?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, I think, by and large, the public understands that other countries conduct espionage on us and that we conduct espionage relating to other countries all over the world. to protect ourselves. And I think that mission is generally supported. Everybody understands that we have, our military is active around the world in many instances there to keep the peace, to protect U.S. interests. And in doing so, we need to understand what other countries are doing and how they are either threatening or possibly in, affecting our interests in one way or the other. And I think people, by and large, understand and support that. And of course, in the post 9/11 era, we understand very vividly the threat of terrorism coming from non-state actors that can affect our interests abroad and on occasion, hopefully very, very rarely, affect inside. So inside our borders. So I think the public is really okay with the notion of collecting intelligence to help advance our national security interests. Because of 9/11, because of the threat that can exist, can cross into our borders, there's been very healthy discussion, I think, about the potential domestic leakage of NSA activities or activities of other intelligence entities about their activities relating to U.S. Citizens. By and large, that is a very minor part of what the entire intelligence community is doing and a minor part of what the NSA is doing. And of course, there we're that is much more controversial. I don't believe that the public accepts that its own government should, quote, spy on it. That doesn't mean the government doesn't collect information on our own citizens. We do that in very, very many ways, totally innocuous ways, like collecting data so we know where to send Social Security checks. We do it in ways that are not innocuous, such as when the FBI gets a search warrant and can look into our computers or our records. And so that is a way the government collects information on us. And then there's a very difficult debate, and it's been a one that spanned history well before 9/11, as to what the role of other intelligence entities, what they may or may not do with respect to U.S. citizens, whether they're at home or abroad. And that's what brings us to this particular topic.
And so that let's turn there now. Again, we're recording on July 2nd. David, as I mentioned in the introduction, I've had a few guests on the show within the last year discussing this issue, most recently Peter Swire discussing the president's report and his work on that commission and his perspective. So you don't have to do from the very beginning, but I'd ask you today, what is the status, if you will, of what we know with regard to the NSA's behavior in this particular area as a result of Snowden? Are there any updates you'd like to offer from, really, let's say, the last month involving the Snowden story, which continues to unfold, and even though this show is airing a week from now, may change by the time we air it?
Well, Snowden had a large cachet of information that he provided to numerous reporters, and they continue to, on occasion, develop new stories, some of which are getting a lot of attention and others less so. Something I saw just yesterday on the internet was a document relating to a certification that the government has to do, I guess, when it goes to the FISA court, identifying certain targets of intelligence that can be gathered under one of the programs, I guess we're going to talk about, PRISM, the Section 702 program. And it lists essentially 193 different governments, and I think that's all of them except for the five governments that we have an agreement that we don't conduct espionage on each other. And that would be the United States, Canada, Great Britain, New Zealand, and Australia. So every other country in the nation was, and the world, excuse me, was on that list. And so that's something I assume came from Snowden and was put on the internet, I believe, by the Washington Post just yesterday. So the story continues to develop. Glenn Greenwald has said that he has other big disclosures. I don't remember how long ago it was, but I think maybe a month or so, there was an important story demonstrating or talking about how the NSA had capabilities to actually capture every single electronic communication from a particular country. And it stated and it disclosed that they were doing so in places like the Bahamas and I can't remember the other countries. The government asked Greenwald not to disclose one of the countries, and he actually agreed. And he got a lot of criticism from the left, particularly from Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, as to what the other country was, which then Assange leaked. I don't know the accuracy of his assertion, but those are some of the things that have been going on lately.
We're chatting with David Schanzer of Duke University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. David, I do want to talk about PRISM and some of the other programs after the break in about 10 minutes. But before we get there, I want to focus a bit on Snowden, not as a person, but really to try to think through his behavior. You wrote a piece last month in Huffington Post entitled "Don't Forget Leakers of Classified Information Are Criminals." And one of the things you wrote that I want to ask you about is really how we might classify, if you will, Edward Snowden. You know, there are a number of labels, as you wrote, that we could put on a person like this. We could say leaker or whistleblower, which has certain connotations to it that sound positive from the perspective of those that want information, but negative from the perspective of their employers, in this case, the government and private sectors. But also you have, as you note, right, criminal or perpetrator, which obviously is a very different connotation, although, and we don't have to get into this level of detail, whistleblowers themselves can also be people that violate the law and often do. And so my question is, you know, ultimately, where do you place him on that range? Because you mentioned Julian Assange, and you have people like Assange, or you might have others like Chelsea Manning, who might fall on one end of the spectrum, and then you know think about someone like the late Aaron Swartz, who was at least being investigated, if not charged, under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act for accessing academic and scholarly work in an unauthorized manner, as perhaps another end of a spectrum like this. So as you think about Snowden, as you wrote, you know, where would you place Snowden on that range of people who release information in an unauthorized manner?
Well, I think there's no doubt, and really very little debate, that Snowden is a criminal. Indeed, I think Snowden himself accepts and recognizes that his activities were criminal, that if he were prosecuted, the evidence is overwhelming that he would be convicted, and that's why he's refusing to come back to the United States without some sort of prearranged an amnesty of sorts or a clemency maybe a plea bargain that would resolve these charges. So I think there's no doubt that he is a criminal. He believes that his criminal acts should be excused, that they were justified in some way, and that therefore they should be excused or perhaps mitigated. The punishment should be mitigated over what it would be in other circumstances, because he believes that he did so out of both noble intentions and beneficial effects to society. So when I think about this, and I guess my thinking has developed, that article you refer to was written, you know, much closer to the time of the initial leaks. As I've thought about this and thinking about this interview, I think I'd call him a misguided criminal dissident. So there's no doubt that he's a criminal. I think he's a dissident because he is objecting to U.S. policy, some fundamental U.S. policies he disagrees with. He would argue that these are things that rise to that. He doesn't make arguments about policy. His argument is about what the Constitution says, and believes that the government is abusing the Constitution, and therefore his actions were not maybe those of a dissident, but those of somebody who was revealing essentially criminal, unconstitutional behavior of the government. We can talk more about the details of that. I disagree. I think, with few exceptions, his actions were really about that he disagreed with policies that the government had instituted with the through our usual process of the consent of through the representative process of lawmaking and execution, then by the executive branch, oversight by the judicial branch. He disagreed with those decisions that had been made, and his actions were taken as a dissident would in opposition. I add the adjective misguided because I think he believes that his actions have been overwhelmingly and entirely beneficial to our country and the world, and I also disagree with his assessment of that. So that's why I'd call him a misguided criminal dissident.
So let me ask you, David, this issue is, I appreciate that definition and that characterization. One of the points that's been made with regard to Snowden having released the information publicly is that Snowden could have and should have, and there's a debate whether he did, take advantage of internal mechanisms inside the NSA to raise concerns about NSA activities, and of course it could get to mundane stuff too, like your day-to-day employment. And my question for you is whether those, if you have knowledge of them, whether those kinds of processes in a meaningful way exist inside the NSA. And the reason I ask the question is this, all right, for many employees, for anyone that's had employment, most people have had jobs where the person for whom you're working says or indicates that they want feedback, positive and negative, but they know that in reality they really can't practically give negative feedback, or if they give negative feedback or commentary, it's going to be held against them. And so I'm asking the question because I've been unable to get a real good fix on this, and perhaps you have a sense of it. Are there mechanisms inside the NSA such that Snowden could have meaningfully both raised these concerns and not has been subject to retribution or some other negative employment consequence? Again, you may not have that knowledge, but it's one that struck me repeatedly when the issue of what Snowden should have done comes up.
Sure. Let's put, for this conversation, let's put the one most controversial program, which is the metadata collection of U.S. person mm-hmm. information. Let's put that aside. That was one disclosure of many, many, probably hundreds of different NSA programs. And let's just put that one aside for the moment. But if you take all the others, there, in my view, there is no argument that anything the NSA was doing was illegal. So even, and we can have a discussion, and I will get to directly to your question about whether the mechanisms for expressing issues are sufficient or not. Let's say we had perfectly transparent and aggressive institutions internally that investigated properly and protected those that disclosed and brought issues up to the decision makers to be vetted that had been brought to them by the attention of employees who saw things that they didn't like. The answer I believe Snowden would have gotten with respect to, and again, I'm putting aside the metadata program, but everything else, all the other hundreds of programs and potentially tens of thousands of documents that he disclosed, was that there is, you might not like the policies, but there is no waste, fraud, abuse with respect to these programs. They are lawful. They've been authorized by the Congress. They're being overseen by the judiciary, yes, in a different way than other programs are overseen by the judiciary, but let's also note that no other country in the world has a judicial oversight over its intelligence operations to the same extent that we do in the United States. So Snowden wouldn't have liked the answer that he received from even a perfectly robust whistleblower protection institution, because those are supposed to exist when an employee sees something that is being done that is illegal, that government funds are being wasted or used in ways that are not authorized by law, if there is theft, actual fraud going on. And I think one of the most interesting things about the whole debate is that, unlike the church committee era, when we had evidence that individuals within the government were not only collecting information that they shouldn't, but then they were using that information for nefarious purposes, for political purposes, for retribution against people they saw as threatening, people like Martin Luther King. Those were abuses. Those were two things. Those were authorities that they were stepping over the line, and they were abusing that authority and using that information for ill purposes. Snowden has revealed not one instance, to my knowledge, that the information that has been collected has been misused in any way for purposes that they were not supposed to be used for. So even if we had the great, and I think we don't, so I'm getting to your answer, no, those whistleblower protection laws and institutions have been much criticized. It is a difficult issue, but I certainly would be supportive of reforms in those areas to make them stronger. I believe the Obama administration has taken some steps in that direction. I certainly would want to extend similar protections to contractors that apply to federal government employees with respect to bringing genuine issues of misconduct, of illegal activities, of waste of government funds, of abuse, of fraud, to the attention of people higher in the organization. And I certainly believe that when that occurs, individuals shouldn't have any retribution taken against them. And the NSA's record and the record of the intelligence community in that regard is not a good one.
We're chatting with David Schanzer of Duke University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station. So let's turn a bit more to the substance. You mentioned the metadata program as putting it aside. Perhaps I'll ask you, David, again. This gets a little bit more into the weeds, perhaps, than many people would. What's different about the metadata program as compared to the other programs that Snowden revealed to the public?
Well, I believe that Snowden's objections were twofold. First of all, he disagreed that the program should exist at all on a policy basis. He didn't think it was necessary, and but I put that one aside because I think whether it was Snowden's objection or it's just that's what was revealed is that the argument had more merit that in some way that this particular NSA program was A, not authorized properly authorized by the Congress, and even if it had been, was unconstitutional and was being implemented in a unconstitutional way. And I think his arguments with respect to that, you know, whether I agree with them or not, they were certainly more reasonable, and so therefore that would be the type of thing that you would, I think, legitimately bring to the attention of the government through a whistleblower protection. Now, he still wouldn't have gotten the answer that he liked, and therefore I think he would have gone ahead and disclosed the information anyway had he gone through that process fully.
What do you base that on, David?
His actions, I think, were a little bit more legitimate in that regard, because he argued that the statute that Congress had passed, Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which allowed the collection of documents that were, quote, related to a terrorism organization, the government, the Obama administration, and maybe the Bush administration as well, I'm not sure, made a very expansive and, I think, creative interpretation of that law to justify its collection of metadata, which are essentially telephone billing records that say the time, place, and who you called of all U.S., of all these telephone companies in the entire United States going back for 5 years. So it's a massive collection of not content, but what we call metadata. I think it's now we're up to 17 or 18 Article III judges who have life protection and salary protection, life tenure and salary protection, have looked at that issue, and one of them have agreed with Snowden, and all the others have disagreed, both on the, not all of them reached the statutory question, but all of them reached the constitutional question. So it remains to be seen if those will go through the courts of appeals. The program has been altered by President Obama. So Snowden could claim that he served a public purpose by disclosing this particular program and leading to change. I don't know if the changes are made because based on politics or based on the merits, whether President Obama thought he ought to change the program because it wasn't really working and it wasn't necessary, or whether he had to do so on a political basis. So on that particular program, this whole episode has a little bit more a feel of a whistleblower who brought something out in the open that the public didn't know about, that it possibly was illegal, and there has been changes as a result of his actions. So that's why I put that particular program in a different category. I think with respect to almost all, maybe all, of his other actions, I don't see that same issues as being apparent, especially with respect to, people outside the United States don't like and have learned a lot about these activities. But I don't think, in terms of what the U.S. government or the U.S. public should feel about it, I don't think that should have... is of as much importance.
The clearly signals intelligence is obviously something that from the moment there were signals, there were efforts by governments to tap them. And of course, there's wonderful and fascinating histories of science from World War II with regard to the Enigma machine and cryptology and so forth that get into these issues. And with regard to those kinds of issues, I want to come back to something that you said, which with regard to Snowden, that you believe that Snowden would have revealed this information, notwithstanding an internal whistleblowing, if you will, or communications process. Is that because you believe that he would not get the answers he wanted, or is there more to that story? On what do you surmise that this information was going to be made public?
Well, he would
Snowden,
have been properly
regardless.
Told by the inspector general or whoever was going to look at his complaints that these activities were properly within the law, that the intelligence that was being collected was important to U.S. national security, and that he had not raised any claim that showed that there was abuse of the government's authority in any way. Mm-hmm. So I don't think he would have felt at all vindicated, or that his view that the NSA was, that this collection of data for national security purposes of people around the world. And yes, we're talking about large volumes of information. Now, a lot of the collection is done, the mass collection is done in order to try to get the smaller nuggets of information that are actually useful and vital. I'm not enough of a technologist to understand entirely, but as it's been told to me, that has to be done in order to get the stuff that is useful and informative to national security. Snowden just didn't believe that was legitimate, and that's why he says he leaked this information, because he thought the NSA was out of control and unaccountable, and that the citizens of the world would be outraged, as they were, to learn about these capabilities. But frankly, as a federal government employee who had sworn to keep the information relating to his job secret, his views about what the citizens of the world were be outraged to know was really not relevant to his job, or was not a legal basis for him to violate the promises that he made. He had every right to leave his job, become an activist, to talk about, in a very general way, hey, governments are collecting way too much personal information against you. You should be aware of that. You should encrypt your messages. I'm sure if he had been spoken in general ways about this as a political activist, it'd be very, very difficult for the government to have taken any sort of action against him. He didn't chose to view his, to bring his political disagreements, his policy views, he didn't choose to do that through that method. He chose a much different method. He chose to use the cover of his job to intentionally put himself in a position where he could get as much access to this kind of information as possible. Then he surreptitiously abused the access that he had to various information systems to collect this information, to put it on a device and bring it out of the secure facility, which was also illegal, and then abscond to another country outside the jurisdiction of United States law enforcement, which happened to be a country that engages in massive spying on its own citizens and runs a police state, China, and then, of course, to one that is pretty much as bad, Russia. So I just don't think that somebody who was essentially a political activist, I don't see his actions as being at all justified in that regard.
We're chatting with David Schanzer of Duke University on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. David, I do want to ask you about that with regard to Snowden's apparent current place of residence, Russia. Former U.S. Ambassador Russia McFaul was on NPR within the last couple of months and was asked by the host whether he felt that it was plausible that Snowden would be in Russia and not be interrogated by Putin and his authorities, and Ambassador McFaul effectively said no, that was implausible to him. In other words, that Snowden must be at some point or another having discussions at that level. I'm curious if you have a perspective on that, or more generally, I think you've alluded to it, on the fact that Snowden is in Russia. Do you think that Snowden, or do you have a basis to know that Snowden is in involved at the level of not just being, as he claims, I'll use your word, dissident, but really a fugitive who is now has asylum in Russia? Do you think it's more pernicious, or there's more involvement than that at that level of the Russian government?
Yeah, former Ambassador McFaul would be in a much, much better position to express a view on that than me. So I think I'll just take a pass on that one.
Okay, fair enough. Let me ask you, and we're reaching the unfair portion of the show, where unfair meaning I'm asking questions that perhaps you need more time to answer, but I ask them anyway. And so I'm going to ask a few here as we face the close of the show. As I know you're aware, and my listeners should be aware, the president formed a commission soon after Snowden's revelations last year that issued a pretty extensive report outlining a number of reforms, some of which were adopted, some of which were not, by the president to address the revelations that existed at that time from Snowden. I'm curious to get your perspective on that report. I mean, in terms of the efficacies of the recommendations, or whether you agree with the thrust of it, what's your take on the president's commission report that was issued?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's a over 300-page report that has over 100, maybe 150 recommendations. So it's a little hard to.
Well, I'm asking for. I recognize
know you
that.
Said
yeah.
You had Peter Swire on your show, who was a member of that panel, and I have a lot of respect for him. I've met him, I think, once or twice, and I assigned some of his writings for my classes. So, Richard Clark also was on that panel and read a lot of his work and respect him as well. I think the commission went a little further. Again, I haven't read every single chapter, and I don't have opinions on every single issue that they addressed. It probably went further than I would have, but I certainly, it was a fine piece of work. I know it was of service to the president. The president has chosen to implement some of the recommendations. He's expressed the desire for Congress possibly to take action on others, and he's ignored, I'd say probably, a majority of the recommendations, or just chosen not to implement, not ignored, maybe looked at them and had a fair disagreement with him. That's not unusual for presidential commissions. I would say I was surprised at how far they were recommending in terms of changes, given who was on the commission. But that was their right, and those are healthy debates for us to be having in a democracy.
So, David, let me ask you another couple of top-level questions as we close. You know, with regard to, you know, the broad issue of secrecy, I'm curious to get your perspective on that, because it would seem, certainly Julian Assange has made this quite clear, but perhaps Snowden as well, that it is exceptionally difficult for the government to keep information under wraps and secret, legitimate reasons or not, to be clear, in an environment where we have the internet and all the means of communication that we know so well. So I'm curious to get your perspective on the government's reliance on secrecy. In your view, should that reliance change? Should the government be rethinking secrecy? I'm sure you're aware that people like Steve Aftergood at the Federation of American Scientists and others have focused heavily on overclassification questions. But my real question is even broader than that, which is reliance on secrecy itself. What is your take on that issue? Has secrecy and the nature of it changed as a result of the internet and of new communication methods? And if so, how should the government react?
Well, there are things that we have to do in secret. There's no doubt about that. If we want to build a stealth aircraft that can evade all existing radar on Earth in order to use for our national security, we can't allow those things to for our adversaries to get, so they can then build radar that will be able to detect it and get all the, you know, we can't do a raid on bin Laden and tell bin Laden on CNN that we are coming. We can't put undercover operatives in other countries undercover who would be killed if it was clear that they were either employees or working for the U.S. government, if we believe it's necessary to do that to get information for our national security. So we have things that we have to do in secret. And, you know, lots of people do things that are secret. They're not classified, but there's no family that, you know, has discussions that they know that they have to be secret in order to do business make things happen. Businesses have to operate with some secrecy. Is secrecy harder in the internet age? Absolutely. Are there too many things that our government, is there overclassification? I agree with Stephen Aftergood. And I would certainly am supportive of reforms that would bring more ability for the public and for people even inside the government who believe that things are overclassified to get a more independent read. Because the incentives inside the government are, you're never going to get in trouble for overclassifying, but you are going to get in trouble for letting information out to the public that shouldn't have been. So all the incentives for people on the inside is to overclassify. Even with this metadata program, I'm not at all convinced that there was any giant secret with respect to it, that somehow Al-Qaeda didn't think that when it made a call into the United States that the government could find a record of it and maybe track through other calls to find out, you know, what the social network looked like. My guess is that they were shaping their operations to avoid the possibility that the government had that capability. So, you know, I think we could have had a debate and an open debate about whether we ought to be doing that without necessarily undermining national security interests. So, yes, I think there's a lot of overclassification. I do think the government has no choice but to act in secret. Is it harder with the internet, with the ability to walk out of a secure facility with a hard drive, with a drive you can put on your pocket that has a million pages of documents? Those are challenges that are more substantial than anybody had to deal with, you know, even 10, but certainly 20 or 30 years ago. So I think it's we have to do our best, and one of the ways to deal with that issue is to classify less. If you're spending so much time and effort to protect so much, everything, by definition, it's harder to really protect the things you need to be protected. So I'd be in favor of classifying less and then doing more to make sure that the things that are really important that don't get disclosed are not disclosed.
Is it your sense, David, and really perhaps this is the last question, is it your sense that as a result of this information being out there, that is what Snowden has leaked, that the public itself has a different perspective of technology? You hear, and I'm sure you're familiar with the calls that say that, you know, privacy is dead and there's no such thing as privacy on the internet anymore. And I'm curious to get your perspective on that. In other words, for those and all of us, right, that use the internet, should we going forward assume that the government, right, and the United States government, and as you indicated, many other governments too, because the U.S. is far from alone in seeking these capabilities and in having them, should assume going forward that your internet communications are simply not private in any way that has previously been understood?
Well, it depends on, you know, private vis-a-vis whom. I tell my kids, I say, you can't put anything in an email or anywhere on social media that you are not prepared for the entire world to know, mm-hmm. because you have lost, once you've hit the send button, you have lost your exclusive control over that piece of information. So an email, by definition, is not private because you have given it to, you've sent that email to someone. Now, you might have a trusting relationship with that person, and they might believe, you might have a very high confidence, and they're not going to share that with anyone. But guess what? You know, married people get divorced, and all of a sudden, things that they said to each other, pictures they took, letters they wrote to each other or whatnot, that they always thought would be private, are now somebody else has them and can distribute them as they like. So your only true protection of privacy, to make something sure something is always private, is to not share it with others or not share it with anyone that you don't have a very, very secure belief that you can trust them. Now, should we assume that every piece of information about us that we put on the internet will be viewed by the government and act accordingly? Frankly, I think that's unnecessary to take that view, because I, you know, do I, quote, trust the government in every way, shape, or form? No, I'm not naive. I know that government makes mistakes, that they do nefarious things, that politics sometimes often affects what governments do to the detriment of the citizenry. I'm not naive in that regard. But given the time, resources, manpower, and woman power that the government has at its disposal, and the massive charge it has in this very complex world where there's crime, internet fraud. There's threats from abroad coming from nation states, non-state actors, and all various variations of them. The government really is not interested or doesn't have the resources to ferret through information that has nothing to do with their job, and for nefarious purposes or purient interests, scale through people's communications on the internet that they believe were private. So because of that reason, I don't really worry that much about the government doing that. I worry a lot more with my kids, for example, that they put things on the internet, or I also am very careful to do it myself. I abide by the New York Times rule, which is don't put anything on writing that you're not prepared to see on the front page of the New York Times, because that is, in some ways, I think, the much bigger threat to privacy in the internet age than government surveillance.
David Schanzer, Associate Professor of the Practice of Public Policy and Director of the Triangle Center for Terrorism and Homeland Security at Duke University, thank you very much for joining us on Hearsay Culture. Obviously, this issue continues, and I certainly invite you back to continue the discussion, but I thank you for taking the time today to chat with my listeners and get into the weeds of a very challenging and complex issue.
Well, I'm happy to do it. I also appreciate the format in which you can really answer complex questions in a reasonable way. So thanks for the opportunity to be with you today.
My pleasure. That's the goal, David. As always, you have a number of ways that you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to the show this quarter, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU-FM Stanford. You can stream the show at that time at kzsulive.stanford.edu. And then the show becomes a podcast where you can get the show at hearsayculture.com. You can get the show at Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu or by going to the iTunes page at CIS through the CIS search at the iTunes search engine, where you can get all previous 215 at this point Hearsay Culture shows, as well as all previous speakers and guests and others that have spoken at CIS over the years. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. I am not going through the upcoming schedule today because we ran a little longer, although I'm very happy to have run longer with Professor Schanzer. So I thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.